Now, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Russia could do something particularly ugly as Ukraine today marks 31 years since they broke free from the Soviet Union, and the day falls 6 months after Russian forces invaded the country on the 24th of February and will be marked by subdued celebrations under the threat of attack from land, air and sea. Well, to discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Ukrainian MP Sviatoslav Jurash and Professor Donika Bakon from the School of Law and Government at Dublin City University. Sviatoslav, thank you for joining us once again today. It is Independence Day where you are. Is it a day of reflection, given the fact that there are no public celebrations taking place due to those security fears that I just outlined? I know he's there, but I can't hear Sviatoslav very clearly. We might just try and fix that line. I'll come to Donika back on. Donika, are you there?
I am indeed.
Thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning. And we'll come back to Sviatoslav in just a moment. Will you tell me a little bit about Independence Day in Ukraine? How important is this day to Ukrainians and to the country?
Oh, it's extremely important. It's the most important day in the calendar. And, you know, a whole generation now has grown up with Independence Day. It goes back to 1991. That's the date when, in August, when Ukraine declared independence from the Soviet Union. That was only 3 weeks after George Bush made a personal plea for Ukraine not to leave the Soviet Union, the so-called Chicken Kiev speech that's now conveniently forgotten by many in his party in America. But as I said, a whole generation, including Deputy Jurash, who hopefully you'll have on the line shortly, has grown up. And I remember well in February when the war started, he's saying very emotively that he was born in an independent Ukraine and he would die in an independent Ukraine, and his own partner, a 25-year-old journalist Alexandra, was killed shortly after the war started by Russian shelling. So this war has affected everybody. It was traditionally a moment of celebration, a moment of reflection, because Ukraine in many ways has a very unlikely independence, for centuries under the domination of many countries, particularly Russia, and divided. And it's a miracle, really, that it emerges in 1991. It had a brief moment of independence between 1917 and 1920. That's when, of course, the Ukrainian flag is first kind of there for an independent state. They had National Flag Day yesterday, of course. The Ukrainian flag, now known to everybody, of course, the blue and yellow, yellow representing the fertility of the land and blue kind of the freedom of the skies. But, you know, it is very emotional, I think, now for many people. They'll be quite stoic today, quite defiant, quite resilient, but it'll be very different from other celebrations which I participated in myself in Ukraine over the years.
Well, Sviatoslav is back with us on the line now, and hopefully we can hear you, Sviatoslav, a little more clearly. Thank you for joining us on the programme once again. It's a muted day today. How will you be marking it?
Thank you very much. I'm in the capital right now, having returned less than a week from the front lines. What I have basically, since my mobilization, fought against the Russians in the east, the fact on the ground is that Ukraine has plenty to celebrate. We have been told by too many actors on the world stage that our capital will fall in a few days, that we will have to resist in parts and ways. But we stood against the Russian onslaught. We pushed them back from the north of the country. We pushed them back from our capital. And we are pushing them in the east. And we will continue to fight until we push the Russians out completely.
And what's your sense of whether the Russians will intensify attacks today to coincide with Independence Day?
Well, in reality, Russians don't need an excuse. They have been firing in different parts of Ukraine. They have been killing civilians, attacking civilian infrastructure day in, day out, night in, night out. So this is not exactly the moment to worry about that. This is something to worry about all the time. Yes, there have been warnings of various kinds, and we are cautious, but this is the moment to try and understand this is but another year in a long story of our statehood and our desire to be an independent nation.
We know there are international concerns about the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, and tensions are high, and there are fears of a nuclear disaster. What is the latest from there?
It's far more than just concerns. This is the biggest nuclear station in Europe, and if it goes up, it's impossible to say what's going to happen internationally and especially in Europe. And the repercussions of that may affect everybody in innumerable ways that the world has never experienced. I have family, actually, living in the vicinity of the occupied nuclear station. It's extremely better the situation, that Russians are doing everything to try and endanger both Europe and Ukraine. And basically, we have to try and appeal to various actors who can at least find different ways for Russia to at least stop threatening the entire world with a nuclear station.
How are you doing? Because you've had such an intense experience over the last 6 months. How are you holding up?
As determined as ever. All the people that we have lost, all the great sacrifice that we have taken is nothing compared to sacrifice of our great-grandparents and grandparents in the pursuit of our own nationhood. So this is, if they withstood that, we'll withstand this. And again, all these people who have died, they have not died in vain. They died for the dream of independent, integral, sovereign Ukraine. That's what we're going to give them.
And when you say you've just returned to the capital city, do you return there for rest and recuperation? Or is your energy, do you still have to be working on the defensive when you're there too?
Well, this is military rotation, so we finished our stint this summer at the front line, so my unit, my platoon, is coming back to, yes, to recuperate a bit, but also to prepare and train to come back in the field, whatever they send us next. And yes, there's plenty of little work as well to attend to, so trying to catch up on that is my intention.
Okay, and Sviatoslav, when it comes to international support and aid, the United States is expected to announce $3 billion in military aid to Ukraine. Is that enough?
Well, the reality is that we are the biggest nation in Europe, and maintaining economic structure, social cohesion, and fighting a war against the biggest nation on Earth is taking great toll, so nothing is enough. But we welcome all the steps that the United States has taken, and all these allies that we have around the world, especially Ireland, which has shown a great deal of grace and help both to our refugees and in terms of political support in our pursuits of Euro-Atlantic institutions.
I want to ask you about this car bombing, Russia blaming Ukraine on the bomb which killed the daughter of an ally of Vladimir Putin. This is Daria Dugina, the daughter of Alexander Dugin. I know Ukraine deny any involvement. What's your own assessment as to what happened?
Daria Dugina is but another character in a long list of characters who essentially have been humdrumming the destruction, killing happening in Ukraine and all around the world. Russia has done throughout Putin's tenure. So the fact on the ground, this isn't in any way something that is out of the ordinary for her or her family or those characters that speak a vile notions on Russian TV every single day. And you have Russian outlets of different kinds taking this and claiming this is their doing. So it's basically, hopefully, the beginning of the reckoning within Russia against characters who have been fundamental in conducting this war against Ukraine and the world.
Sviatoslav, thank you for joining us again on the programme. That's Sviatoslav Yurash, who's a Ukrainian MP. Professor Donnacona Bacon is here listening to all of that. I know you bore witness to an event yesterday called the Crimean Platform, which was addressed by delegates, including Micheál Martin. What did that tell you about the attitude of the rest of the world towards Ukraine?
Well, it was a very interesting event, the second of its kind. The first was held last year before the war, and that's why it's kind of called the Crimea Platform, because it was focusing on the main area that Russia had occupied prior to this more recent invasion, that being Crimea. And it was a very impressive demonstration of support for Ukraine. About 60 delegations addressed President Zelensky online, including, as you say, Taoiseach Micheál Martin. So they were each given about 2 or 3 minutes. And it started, you know, from Olaf Scholz and Emmanuel Macron and went down through to the list. And they were all on the same page. They were all saying that their support was unequivocal. It was absolute. And it was for the long haul. I think there was an increasing recognition that this is going to be a longer war than many had anticipated. But there was a strong element of defiance there. And he was kind of accompanied by the president of Poland, who is in Kiev, and they gave a press conference before the Crimea Platform. And it was at that press conference that President Zelensky, I think, gave a snapshot of where the Ukrainian government's thinking is at the moment. It was very defiant. It was saying that only when Russia removed its troops from all of Ukraine, including Crimea, would there be a resolution, that the war had started in Crimea and it would it would end in Crimea. And interestingly, the Turkish president, Erdogan, supported Ukraine on this issue of Crimea, said that the morality and international law, you know, meant that Crimea is Ukraine.
You know, we heard yesterday about the resumption of the Football League in Ukraine. We also hear that grain exports are reaching pre-war levels. And yet we have, as I was saying to Sviatoslav, $3 billion in military aid going to Ukraine. So we can't assume that this war is reaching any sort of a conclusion, or indeed that life as normal is returning to Ukraine.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I mean, the war continues, and it's very arbitrary. It's still in flux. I mean, Russia has demonstrated in recent days and weeks its willingness to apply, you know, terror to any city at any time. And that's why Kyiv is on high alert today. Other cities are on high alert. And that is the regular occurrence. Nobody is taking anything for granted. And as you know, one third of the Ukrainian population have left their homes since the beginning of the war, and therefore are living away from home. And there's a whole range of other issues which are ongoing. I mean, the economy has been strangled since the beginning of the war. But there is, I think, as Deputy Urash outlined, there is a certain degree of resilience there and optimism that Ukraine will come out of this. You have to remember the Ukraine's national anthem, I think, is very appropriate for moments like this. It's Ukraine is not dead yet. And there is that kind of feeling that Ukraine can bring this to a successful conclusion if given sufficient support.
I want to talk to you about what's happening in Mariupol with what's been alleged to be show trials of Ukrainian prisoners in that city. And the UN Human Rights Office said that the process of those trials, that could amount to war crimes. What's your analysis of what's happening there?
Well, yes, that's what the United Nations have said. Mariupol, of course, is of a very strong symbolic importance to Russia. You remember how the fight to occupy the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol generally led to such destruction. It was a city of 500,000 people. Most of those have fled. Many have been killed. We'll still never know exactly how many. So now we see that the Russians are essentially, they have the prisoners of war, and they're preparing, it seems, Mariupol Philharmonic into a prison. And they're preparing large cages for some kind of show trial. They might have actually prepared the theatre. That was one of the major buildings in the city. But, of course, that was destroyed controversially with the words children written outside. So it is something that's aroused a lot of emotions because of the heroic defence of Mariupol by those prisoners. And of course, the Ukrainian government and the international community takes a very active interest in their welfare. And, of course, over 50 of them were killed recently in controversial circumstances. So, the United Nations has been quite clear that, you know, willfully depriving a prisoner of war of a right to a fair trial amounts to a war crime. So this is something that the United Nations will be keeping a very close focus on in the coming weeks.
And there are also allegations of the forced adoption of Ukrainian children.
That's right. There was an official announcement from Russia saying that 1,000 children had found homes in Russia, and this is you know, a much larger number have been forcibly deported to Russia. You know, once the areas were occupied during the course of the war, and from the Ukrainians' perspective, this is part of the genocidal campaign against the Ukrainian people. That, you know, that essentially the parents are being killed or rounded up, and the children then are being, you know, forcibly abducted and taken to be Russified in Russia with no consultation with parents or relatives that are still living.
All right, Professor Donico, back on. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, later on in the programme, we're going to be bringing you the latest on the manhunt in Liverpool after a 9-year-old girl, Olivia Pratt Coble, was killed when a gunman entered his house. He seemed to be chasing another man. I see now reports that a man has been arrested this morning for breaching the terms of his release from prison and will be questioned in relation to that murder. We'll bring you more on that later on in the programme. Right now, though, a quick break.